Now winding up today's program, Jan Hocken is back talking with psychiatrist Elizabeth Berger about the role of international networks in supporting Palestinians living under Israeli occupation and some of the links between human rights and mental health. Berger is a child psychiatrist living in New York City and on the steering committee for the USA Palestine Mental Health Network. Jan?
Elizabeth Berger, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Good to be here.
In a recent article, you and your co-author talk about the psychological impact of living under occupation for the Palestinian people, and I'd like to start with a quote from that article. Under occupation, the people of Palestine face a purposefully inflicted degradation of the entire system of meaning which has given them identity as a people. Not only individual selves, but the collective self has been damaged, unquote. Well, let's start with having you describe some of these psychological dynamics and effects of living under occupation that I know you've written about and also been very close to through your work in Palestine. And then we can turn to how you and your Palestinian colleagues are addressing the suffering on both the individual and collective levels you cite as so important. So let's start with some of those dynamics you've described.
Sure. As a context, in the occupied territories, daily life frequently involves being stopped at checkpoints or in the street by occupying soldiers for no reason at all. These are frequently occasions for being verbally insulted, slapped, interrogated endlessly, undressed in public, or menaced with weapons. Harassment by soldiers or settlers happens every day. The experiences of home incursion, often in the middle of the night, and detention are also commonplace and particularly harrowing. These traumatic humiliations pose a challenge for mental health practice. How can a man who's been slapped and abused in front of his wife and children resume his role as a protective husband and father? How can a woman who's been physically tied up and subjected to sexual taunts in interrogation, resume her life as a full human being? There are limitations to our standard mental health approaches to meet the needs of people who've endured this kind of mistreatment. The first limitation is the enormous scope of the problem of humiliation in Palestine. Violence has formed the core of the Palestinian reality since 1948 and continues today in conditions of grave material hardship. The Palestinian community, over 5 million people, is subject to wars, bombings, shootings, house demolitions, destruction of farmland, checkpoints and closures, fragmentations of neighborhoods, extrajudicial assassinations, states of siege, and particularly mass detention. It's estimated that over one-third of all Palestinian men since 1967 have been detained in Israeli prisons, often without any charges being brought against them, and sometimes for decades. Men, women, and children are often mistreated in detention, to a degree constituting torture. Over a period of 6 months in 2014, for example, there were over 600 children arrested just in Jerusalem, of which nearly 40% reported sexual abuse. The consequences of detention alone constitute an enormous public health problem. These insults and injuries are accompanied by a global propaganda campaign, which projects a debased image of Palestinian identity as dangerous, irrational, and dishonest. Through this, the intangible and cultural heritage of the Palestinian people has suffered a further degradation. A second limitation to conventional mental health treatment is at the core of humiliation is shame, and the experience of shame is particularly difficult to address with standard therapies. CBT, for example, is more effective with aspects of trauma-related symptoms, such as fearful re-experiencing, rapid heart rate, than with the experience of shame. Then, too, shame interferes with the capacity to remember and to articulate a personal narrative. Humiliated persons want to hide. Withdrawal from intimacy within family and social relationships thus further damages the potential for therapy and for recovery. Reactions to humiliation can also stimulate disorganized feelings of rage, which undermine treatment and can be misdirected. Humiliation stimulates community polarization and may contribute to impulsive and destructive actions aimed at achieving revenge. What can we say then about the need for the integration of innovative approaches to repair the impact of humiliation in Palestine? There's certainly room for conventional interventions such as medications as well as psychotherapy. But we recommend that we widen our therapeutic scope in interpersonal and collective directions. For example, since humiliation attacks identity, especially the expression of identity through social worlds, an exploration of sources of connection, such as couples counseling or family-oriented treatment, may be especially helpful, as well as efforts toward re-involvement broadly in cultural and community groups and in political action. We also have to recognize that not everyone is a patient. One adolescent who had suffered in detention was brought to a psychiatrist by his family, but refused to cooperate with the interview, saying, "I'm not crazy." For many ex-detainees, a discussion group made up of peers with a leader who himself has experienced the humiliation of detention may be more appropriate. Groups such as the Prisoners Club in Palestine offer self-help based on this model. But beyond the problem of humiliation with individuals includes an entire people whose integrity and value have been under assault as a culture. So there's a therapeutic meaning in a solidarity movement which holds the State of Israel accountable for these wrongs on an ethical level. And of course, in the big picture, there can be no genuine and full validation of the Palestinian narrative without the actual restoration of justice. Working toward an end of politicized humiliation can open the door to reconciliation on an international as well as a personal level, in which it is possible for injury to be counted, acknowledged, and worked through.
Well, let's talk some about that process of acknowledging and working through in this vision of a kind of community psychiatry that also goes beyond bearing witness or documenting or acknowledging trauma, but also carries a kind of moral responsibility for addressing it, its sources. And I know one of the programs you've been very active in working with as a child psychiatrist along with colleagues is a program through the schools, a comprehensive in-school student support mental health program. Can you tell us about that program, what you're doing and what you hope to achieve?
Sure. Working with these themes, we've developed a wonderful mental health program for children in Palestine through an international organization, the Palestinian Medical Education Initiative, or PMED, under our executive director, Dr. Michael Morse. The school program is now in its third year of operation with several schools thus far in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The comprehensive student support program model involves one trainer working intensively with one school for a period of 1 year. Its two goals are to enhance coping among all students and to implement individualized plans for specific students who present learning, behavioral, or psychological problems. All aspects of the program are delivered in Palestine by Shireen Abdeen, our excellent PMED mental health clinician and trainer. To create genuine community supporting student mental health, the clinician trainer brought together the entire school staff, including the principal, guidance counselors, and all teachers, for 12 hours of intensive workshops on mental health. The training stressed the importance of communication with students and alertness to signs of individual distress, such as poor grades or disruptiveness, as well as school-wide issues such as bullying. An important aim of the school staff training was changing the school culture from a punishment model to an encouragement model for student discipline. During the year, all of the parents, too, were invited to a similar 12-hour training program addressing some of the common problems that children might present at school. and the role of psychological factors in these problems. Both the school staff trainings and the parent trainings were evaluated by participants as very valuable. Some parents and teachers described them as life-changing. A key element in the program was creating within the school a weekly committee composed of the school principal, the guidance counselor, and two teachers. Each meeting, led by the trainer, lasted 2 to 3 hours. The committee established a communication pyramid that assigned each member to a small group of teachers to capture input from all enrolled students, teachers, and committee members with responsive communication both directions. The committee then developed a daily 15-minute activity for the entire school, each week with a new theme. For example, how the students felt about their relationships at home with teachers or with peers. Each student would write a response, which would be collected. Through this activity, the staff gained insight into meaningful issues within the lives of students, and this new knowledge formed the basis of activities. For example, when students were asked, "How do I feel when someone calls me names or hits me?" Their written responses inspired classroom discussions and special workshops for students, parents, and teachers on bullying and healthier ways to promote conflict resolution. One pressing issue with profound impact on student well-being was the escalating military and settler violence from the occupying forces that erupted in October 2015 in Jerusalem. Many students seemed agitated by these violent events, while others were withdrawn and demoralized. The weekly committee in Jerusalem schools then instituted several crisis intervention programs, such as an art project, an exercise relaxation project, and a balloon activity for younger children, in which students attached balloons to their legs and ran around the room bursting the balloons. The school reached out to all of its families through social media, encouraging parents to prepare special foods and engage their children in special activities during these difficult days. In addition to these activities aimed to enhance coping overall within the student body, each committee addressed individual students who presented special problems. Many of these students had already earned a negative reputation within the school, but others who had previously escaped notice were now being referred to the committee. The 15-minute activity had proven to be a sensitive instrument to alert teachers to troubled youngsters. A quiet child might pass in a paper saying, "I hate my father," during a writing exercise, or draw a morbid picture related to military violence. In this way, the school was able to identify students at risk. Each student referred to the committee was entered into a list and given a score. 10 indicated big problems, and a 0 indicated that the problems were now resolved. The committee would then gather information from meeting with teachers and inviting parents for a conference, and in this way develop a plan. Sometimes a plan would be quite simple for the classmates to list all the likable things about a particular student, for example. For other students, the committee plan might involve referring the student to the guidance counselor or developing a behavioral contract. About a third of the students on the committee's list were referred to outside agencies in the community for professional evaluation. A child who seemed to have difficulty hearing, to require an evaluation for learning disability, or to consult with a psychiatrist for possible diagnosis such as ADHD or autism spectrum disorder. A small number of youngsters received medications from psychiatrists in the community, which in most cases led to dramatic improvement. Although initially, stigma caused families to be resistant to these outside referrals to professional clinicians, over time, more than three-quarters of the family did follow through. At the end of the year, we found that students on the committee's list experienced significant improvement. Over 80% of these students were rated as improved. It's our conclusion, then, that the trauma of the occupation damages mental health through many pathways, both direct and indirect. The common denominator is disrupted relationships expressed in multiple areas, such as family distress, peer conflict, and poor relationships between students and teachers, bullying among students and punitive behaviors by parents and teachers are key examples of trauma-related relationship patterns that impact student and family well-being. Palestine's a people culture. Harnessing this cultural value in mental health programming can enhance well-being in sustainable ways. I'd like to close by saying that childhood can only be as secure as a family and community that supports that childhood. So student mental health in Palestine depends ultimately on a global effort to guarantee justice and freedom to people of Palestine so that they and their children can have the opportunities to fulfill their full potential as human beings.
Well, Elizabeth Berger, this is such an important work you and your colleagues are carrying out, and listeners can learn more about your work through the Palestinian Medical Education Initiative. The website will be posted on our website along with your piece today, and more about the USA Palestine Mental Health Network that you're a part of, and people can also learn about a petition, a protest of an international conference that's scheduled next year in Tel Aviv, and you've been part of protesting that as part of that network. And I'd also like to point out that much of the work there, which focuses on teachers as activists and having insights about what it means to be part of an ethical community, shares a great deal in common with what teachers are doing in West Virginia now. And so viva all teachers in the world who have so much, carry a lot of responsibility, but also have so much to teach.
Absolutely. Well, certainly we appreciate if you can post these links on the KABU website, and absolutely, I think what we see in Palestine has great applicability globally for people struggling everywhere.
Yeah, and there's much about equity. joy and play and pleasure, as well as trauma and suffering. That is part of what you described today. Thank you so much for being with us. This is Jan Hocken talking with Elizabeth Berger about the work of mental health and education in Palestine. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. A pleasure.